From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Harvey Pekar has chronicled his life in his series of autobiographical comics, American Splendor. His life was dramatized in the film American Splendor, and he was portrayed by Paul Giamatti. Now Pekar has written a book-length comic called Quitter about his childhood in Cleveland. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Pekar. Also, how smugglers, traffickers, and copycats are hijacking the global economy. We talk with Moises Naim about his book, Illicit. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new album from the band My Morning Jacket. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In Harvey Pekar's series of autobiographical comics, American Splendor, which he began in 1976, he's chronicled the day-to-day aspects of his life, things like working as a file clerk at a VA hospital in Cleveland, collecting jazz records, running into annoying friends and strangers, the ups and downs of married life, and being constantly disgruntled by how little money he makes. Pekar's life was dramatized in the 2003 movie American Splendor, in which he was brilliantly portrayed by Paul Giamatti. The movie ends with Pekar's retirement from his file clerk job. Having ended that portion of his life, he's looked back to an earlier part of his life. His new memoir is about his childhood. It's a hardcover, book-length comic called Quitter. Pekar writes his comics and has worked with several different illustrators, including his old friend R. Crumb. Quitter is illustrated by Dean Haspiel. What really surprised me reading your new book was that you were a street fighter when you were young. You always struck me as more argumentative, but not as someone who would enjoy a good fist fight. So, I don't know. Is this like a more hidden part of your past?
Well, I guess it's hidden if you don't know about it. I didn't write very much about my early life in previous issues of American Splendor, and. So I didn't talk about it. It used to be a big part of my life, and I didn't used to really enjoy beating up people. What I used to enjoy was, like, the acclaim and stuff. I was living in a neighborhood where the toughest guy was, got the most respect, and I wasn't getting a whole lot of respect in those days, and I didn't used to pick fights, but. Like, if I'd get in an argument with a guy, and it'd go to a certain point, or he'd start cursing at me or something, I'd smack him.
Well, let's go back to the neighborhood you grew up in. You write that, when you were growing up, your parents were Jewish immigrants from Poland. You'd lived in a neighborhood that had become predominantly African-American, so you were one of the few white kids in your school, and you actually got beaten up a lot. How did it affect your self-image to be beaten up a lot?
I didn't like it. I mean, it really messed me up. Every day when I would come back from school or go to, back to my house for lunch or something like that during lunch break, there'd be a bunch of guys, that would jump me. And I had to fight through that kind of scene for, a couple of years. And nobody talked to me on the street. I was just, completely shunned. And as a result, I actually started to think of myself as some kind of an inferior. And,
Why do you think you were picked on so much? Did it have to do with being white or being what they considered nerdy? What was it, do you think?
Well, it was being white. They used to call me White Cracker. That was my nickname. And so I would just, be by myself all the time. I got going when I started reading. That helped me out a lot. I learned how to read, and I would read comic books and stuff, and that helped.
Well, I think it was when you were in high school, your family moved to a different neighborhood, and this was a predominantly white neighborhood. And then instead of being picked on all the time, you turned into a bully. How did that happen?
I didn't exactly turn into a bully. It's just gradually... I'm pretty strong for my age. I mean, I was pretty strong for my size and my age in those days, and I was a pretty decent athlete. I never got a chance to find out about this until I moved to this other neighborhood, because I like, for instance, when I was fighting, I would always be fighting several guys at once, and I never had a chance to participate in sports or anything like that, because I was sort of, just left out of it. Nobody wanted me.
So in high school, you feel like you didn't exactly turn into a bully, but now that you were fighting people one-on-one instead of one against a group, You did well. You won most of your fights. So,
yeah.
How did that change how you carried yourself in school and how you thought of yourself?
Well, I was a lot more confident about myself because, you know, I bought into this idea that the toughest kid was the most respected kid. And I figured that I was the most respected kid. And I noticed that even though, I read a lot and I was kind of scholarly in some ways, nobody used to give me a hard time about it because they know I would fight back.
Your new book is called The Quitter. What are some of the things you quit when you were younger?
Well, I quit baseball. I quit football. I quit classes in school that challenged me to take easier classes. Then after I got out of high school, I got a bunch of jobs and some of them I quit because I had these kind of crazy fears about just being a failure no matter what I did. Like, for example, in the post office, so I worked at the post office, and I would be afraid to. I would think I was going to be screwing up if I bound up bundles of letters and twine because I thought I was so mechanically incompetent that I wouldn't tie them tightly enough and they would come apart and the bosses would blame me for screwing up, so before that could happen I quit. I know it sounds crazy, but yeah, it was kind of a crazy scene. And there wasn't really much I could do about it.
You joined the Navy, and you didn't quit that, but you were asked to leave.
Yeah, I was asked to leave because with the mechanical stuff, I couldn't pass inspections. I just got all hung up about about washing my own clothes, and I couldn't tell whether my clothes were dirty or clean, and I would be standing there at the sink. Scrubbing my clothes whenever everybody else was through, and I wouldn't know whether they were clean or dirty.
You were told that you didn't have the flexibility for Navy life.
Yeah, that was officially what they said. Well, I guess I didn't. Not that I really loved the Navy that much, but I was just looking for a place to land, a place that I could survive. Some kind of job, something. After a while, I set my sights really low. I just wanted to find something that was easy and paid me enough so that I could just barely get by, and something that was steady. And finally, I found that in the civil service, working for the VA hospital
as a file clerk.
That's right. I have a total of 37 years in with the federal government as a file clerk.
And you did that till your retirement. And here's something I find really interesting. Your book is called The Quitter. As a young man and as a high school student, you quit all kinds of things. But you've also had incredible stick-to-itiveness. I mean, you stayed at this one job for, 37 years. You started doing comics when you were, in your 20s? 32. Okay, and you're about 65 now, and you're still doing them, and you've done them, and you're now like pretty well known for them. You've been married how many years?
Well, this last time I've been married for 22 years.
That's a pretty long time. And you've been in your house how long?
I've been in my house about 15 years.
Yeah, that's a pretty long time, too. So how do you kind of reconcile the part of you that's a quitter with the part of you that kind of finds something and just stays with it?
Well, when I find something I can handle, that doesn't, mess me up or anything like that, I stick to it. I hold on to it with a death grip, like my civil service job. God, I thought, God, I'll never find another job like this again. It's so ideal for me, it's easy. I don't have to go home and worry about the work. I just go and, do the work and go home and think about writing something. And, you know, I had health insurance. And so, I mean, why wouldn't I want to stay with that? I didn't think I possibly could do any better than that. I thought that was the best I could possibly do. And, you know, maybe I was right.
Now, what about sticking with American Splendor, the comic series that you've been doing for about 30 years or more? Did you, you know, it didn't start out, I mean, it hasn't, until the American Splendor movie, it wasn't, and maybe even after that, it hasn't been like a very lucrative thing. And the attention that you've gotten for it came, I think, kind of slowly. So what kept you doing it even when you weren't getting a lot of, like, financial awards or acclaim or recognition?
Well, I did get some critical notice, and that was a big thing to me. I mean, it was a big thing to me to be a writer. And I was, like, sort of on a mission with American Splendor, too. I wanted to try to prove that comics could do things. I wanted to expand them beyond superheroes and talking animals. And I knew that was going to take a long time, but I just started, you know, writing autobiography and about, you know, my quotidian life. And, you know, because I think everybody's life's interesting, I just kept on going at it, and I developed a small group of followers that, you know, used to write to me, and I mean, it was like I had some, you know, people say get a life. Well, I mean, that was part of my life, you know. It was a social connection. Other than that, I really didn't have too much. I would just get up and go to work and come home.
My guest is Harvey Pekar. His new book-length comic is called Quitter. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Harvey Pekar. His new book-length autobiographical comic is called Quitter. He's best known for his series of autobiographical comics, American Splendor. In the film American Splendor, about Pekar's life and work, he was portrayed by Paul Giamatti. The film ended with Pekar's retirement from his longtime job as a file clerk at a VA hospital in Cleveland. Now that you don't have your day job, you're retired from that, you can write as much of the, you can spend as much of the day writing as you'd like. I think most writers find it really hard to write for a good deal of the day. So what's your work schedule like? You might have dreamed all your life of having that kind of flexibility. Now that you have it, what's it like to have it?
Yeah, it's a very good question, Terry. It would be pretty hard for me to write, you know, 40 hours a week, you know, 8 hours a day to work that kind of week like I did when I was at the VA. I need these writing gigs to get extra income. And I'm taking just about any kind of job I can get. And, you know, Some of the jobs don't pay that much, so I'm finding that I'm spending more and more time writing, actually, and I think that's the way it's going to be if I'm lucky. If I'm lucky, I'll just be busy and I'll just have to grit my teeth and write for however long it takes to, you know, to do the job, because I want to, you know, I have a wife and a kid to support. I want to take care of that. That's important to me.
Did you have to learn how to deal with an unstructured day, a day that wasn't structured by a 9-to-5 job?
Yeah, I did. At first it freaked me out. In fact, you know, I got so depressed and screwed up, I was hospitalized, you know, for major depression.
When was this?
Well, I retired like in October of 2001, and then in November they shot the movie, and then I had a good time going down onto the set and watching them shooting the movie and stuff, but when it was over, it was like there was no structure in my life. And I think maybe this happens to a lot of guys when they retire. And I just got real nervous and depressed and had to be hospitalized for it. And for about a year and a half, I was in and out of the hospital several times until I just made up my mind that, first of all, you know, being in the hospital wasn't going to help me. And I just have to grit my teeth and just do what I had to do or you know, die trying or something.
Do you think that the depression was brought on in part by having to face a lot of writing, or do you think it was brought on in part by facing the kind of void in existence that can be brought on when you don't have things that are kind of occupying you on a regular basis?
Right. I hadn't really faced up to the idea of structuring my time in my life, and I you know, people could maybe warn me about it, but until I actually faced the problem, it didn't, you know, I didn't realize how serious it was.
How do you think it's affected your life to have put so much of your personal life out there? In your comics over the years, you've written about, you know, fights with your wife and, you know, arguments with friends and workers and insecurities that you have. I mean, it seems like all kinds of things that go through your mind or all kinds of things that you've experienced for better and for worse have ended up in your comics over the years. And your goal in these comics isn't to just present yourself in a flattering light. It's to try to be really honest about what day-to-day life is like. How has that affected you to have all of that out there?
Well, I don't mind it if I show myself being cheap or, you know, being, you know, unreasonable sometimes. You know, at least I haven't killed anybody. And so that's not a problem for me. If I did something really heinous, I guess I wouldn't want to write about it. But I've continued to write about my life as it is, hoping that people will identify with, you know, some of the things that I do, some of the things that I think, and you know, take maybe even comfort. Like, for example, when my wife and I did this book, Our Cancer Year, it didn't sell very well. I think it's the worst selling of all my, square back books.
And this was a journal of when you had cancer.
Right.
In comic form.
Right. It was something like 212 pages about what it was like having cancer and what it was like for my wife to take care of me. And people have ever since then, you know, told me that they really, you know, it was really important for them to read that book because, you know, they thought that maybe they were the only one that was going through this stuff. And I guess when their experience was universalized, I guess it made it a little easier to take.
You know, when I think about your life, I think about somebody who has this almost like inherently bohemian spirit, you know, somebody who's whose life is so caught up in jazz and literature and language, and yet you spend so much of your life having this really straight 9-to-5 file clerk job. And do you see that as a paradox of your life? You know, leading this like very straight life, but at the same time being just kind of inherently bohemian at the same time.
Yeah. Well, no. I just tried to live on, you know, on two different levels. I knew I couldn't make money at the stuff I liked doing. So I took a job that was not challenging, and when it was slow at work, I used to sneak off in a corner and read. As a matter of fact, I would take books with me all the time to work. I could get my work done, you know, pretty quickly, and I would, you know, like, I would sneak off someplace to, you know, to read or write, it worked out. I guess if I'd had a tougher job, maybe I wouldn't have read so much.
Well, Harvey Pekar, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Harvey Pekar's new book-length comic book memoir is called Quitter. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from NPR member stations and from Barnes & Noble, featuring Secrets of the Widow's Son by David Shugarts, a look at the upcoming sequel to The Da Vinci Code. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how smugglers, traffickers, and copycats are hijacking the global economy. We talk with Moises Naim. He's the editor of the magazine Foreign Policy and author of the new book Illicit. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the band My Morning Jacket. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The global economy has a parallel underground illicit market where everything is sold, from bootleg DVDs and fake Gucci accessories to machine guns, rocket launchers, illegal drugs, endangered species, cadavers, and sex slaves. My guest Moises Naim has written a new book called Illicit: How Smugglers, Traffickers, and Copycats Are Hijacking the Global Economy. Naim is the editor of the magazine Foreign Policy, which is published by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the former executive director of the World Bank and served as Minister of Industry and Trade in Venezuela. Now, you write that the people who are investigating illicit markets and trying to crack them have used the mafia as the model, but the networks have changed. You say they're really more decentralized, like Al-Qaeda, than they are like the mafia. Can you give me an example of a illicit network that looks more like Al-Qaeda than the mafia?
Well, imagine we have evidence of Ukrainian arms runners and traffickers of women that are in alliances with Colombian and Mexican traffickers, in which they traffic and exchange, for example, weapons for cocaine. Or we have found there is evidence of Nigerian traffickers working in northern Thailand. This is not a structured hierarchical organization that has a boss and therefore several under bosses and is a pyramid. These are very flexible, very agile, stateless networks that develop opportunistic arrangements, and that if they work together for a while, then disassemble, then do it again. And what's evident now is that the specialties are no longer as important as the ability to move illicit goods, services, people from across borders. So a network can, in Morocco, for example, can move to Spain both drugs, weapons, or people. The same we have seen in the border between Mexico and the United States, where traditional drug-running networks now also operate in running people and arms.
So even the drug trade isn't like the big South American drug cartels like it used to be?
The drug trade has changed in very important ways. New entrants, new people, new groups, new networks are operating. A lot of the drugs are no longer harvested but cooked. We have in the future of the drug trade is not harvesting something and then moving it to another country, but cooking it in makeshift labs or very even industrial labs in some countries. It has also changed in the sense that traditional countries that were transshipment countries have now become big markets. For example, Brazil, that used to be a transshipment place for drugs produced in the Andean countries, in Peru, in Bolivia, in Colombia. Now Brazil is a huge market and continues also to be a transshipment place. And there are new products. Technology has changed the drug trade. A very important drug trade that accounts for $7 billion a year takes place in the Pacific Northwest, where there is an export from Canada called BC Bud, British Columbia Bud, which is a type of marijuana that is very potent and very sought after by consumers and distributors. That trade did not exist a few years ago, and it now exists thanks to changes in technology. They have adapted and used biotechnology. You know, marijuana is no longer produced only in the tropical places. It can be produced in very cold places, like British Columbia. So there is technology, and technology that is biotechnology, technology that is communications technology, that uses all sorts of new means, from calling cards to the internet to BlackBerries to pagers to very low costs of transportation, that were one of the changes of the 90s, have facilitated these illicit trades of all kinds.
And another problem you point out is that authorities are often willing or happy to take bribes and payoffs, kickbacks from the illicit drug traffickers.
Yes. What I point out is that illicit trade, the criminal trades, have grown in ways that has changed them. They have mutated into activities that we have not seen before in history. They are now global. They are now very, very wealthy. They are connected internationally to politicians. They are if you are very successful in business, the three things you do is that you diversify first. Second, if your industry is highly regulated, you get very close to government officials and to regulators. And third, if you're very successful, you also buy legitimacy by donating money to orchestras, sports clubs, churches, good works of all kinds. The illicit traffickers are also doing that. They are very successful. They have piles and piles of money. And their industry is very regulated. Indeed, it is banned. So the return on their investment in government relations, in getting close or even owning governmental officials and agencies, is very high, as is their investment in legitimacy, in social acceptance. And the more that happens, the more money they have, the closer they get to government officials, the more the whole apparatus of policies in countries, in entire countries, gets compromised and even captured by the interests of illicit traders.
Let's look at the illicit arms trade. And you say the biggest factor since the end of the Cold War in the illicit arms trade was the transformation of the former Soviet bloc and its effect on arms producers there. You say virtually every country in Central and Eastern Europe has a small arms industry.
Yeah, there is a proliferation of small arms, and it's not only in the former Soviet Union. Yeah, you now find very important arms, small arms production in places like Ghana or Chile, or even in East, in places in East Asia. And what's happening is, it's very interesting to see how it is banned, it is prohibited, there are all sorts of embargoes, but we have not heard the first instance of an insurrection as an armed group, a guerrilla group, that has gone out of business because it lacks weapons or ammunition. So this is another trade that is completely prohibited and banned in many ways for civilians in around the world, and yet it thrives.
Since 2004, it's no longer a criminal offense in the United States to own a military-grade assault weapon. Is that affecting the international arms trade and the illicit arms trade?
No, no insurgency, no guerrilla movement in the world has lacked for suppliers of weapons. So the United States is just one, albeit a very important one, but it's not the only one. And the regulations or the freedom with which weapons are produced and sold in the United States is certainly a very good opportunity for these traders. A former president of Colombia, President Pastrana, told me when he learned that the United States has deregulated and allowed the free production and sales of this assault weapon, he was indignant. He told me that day in and day out, very honest, decent policemen and judges and law enforcement officials in Colombia are gunned down with American-made weapons. And that while they're trying, that if they did that, they would probably be put in a blacklist somewhere. Whereas in the United States, this production of weapons and the freedom with which these weapons are made available creates interesting, attractive opportunities for traders and drug traders and criminals of all kinds. But again, I don't want to just center it in the United States because it's not the main source. It is a very important source, but as I said before, weapons are plentiful.
My guest is Moises Naim, author of the new book, Illicit. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Moises Naim. He's the editor of Foreign Policy and author of the new book, Illicit, How Smugglers, Traffickers, and Copycats Are Hijacking the Global Economy. I think, like most Americans, don't directly encounter the illegal arms trade and don't directly encounter the illegal narcotics trade, but probably many Americans do encounter illegal goods, knockoffs of fashions, handbags, Gucci's, Prada's. When did that become so big, the illegal knockoff, the international illegal knockoff industry?
It grew. It always existed, but it was always of low quality and easily recognizable. And today, you have a hard time differentiating a knockoff from the real thing. And it is, as I said before, a business that generates losses of about $630 billion a year to the legitimate owners of these trademarks and products. In the early 90s, these trades existed, and the counterfeited products, the trade in counterfeited products did exist. But it was not as huge as it is now. That has to do with the emergence of China, with outsourcing of production of a lot of these goods in China by the legitimate owners, and by the opening of the world trading system that was deregulated, and by the ability of these traders to connect in complex ways through the networks. If you go in any of the streets of the major capitals, if you go in, walk in the streets of Manhattan, you will see that a lot of the people that sell these counterfeited products are illegal immigrants themselves. If you go to Europe, you'll find that they are also illegal immigrants, and very often from the same countries. They may not know each other. But that tells you that there is a very interesting connection between the people's trade and the counterfeiting trade. Just imagine the difficulty of stealing a product designed in Europe, moving it to China, copying almost identically, and putting it, manufacturing it in huge volumes, and distributing it in the street corners of all the major capitals. And this happens in matter in very quickly. All of the people, the industries that are victims of these trades will tell you that their products are copied almost at the speed of light. Very often, they are released by the counterfeiters earlier than the official release of the product by the legitimate owner. So if you think in terms of the managerial challenges entailed of doing all of these things, all of the steps involved, and then you add the fact that most of them are illegal, then you conclude that this is impossible without huge complicity on the parts of governmental officials.
In analyzing the illicit trade of arms and drugs and knockoffs, did you go on the road into some of these capitals of illegal business and try to see for yourself what's going on?
Yes, I did. I did visit not all of them, but I visited quite a few of them. I also met with all sorts of actors involved in this, law enforcement officials and prosecutors, and also some of the traders themselves. In the book, I talk about a person I call Don Alfonso. Don Alfonso is a very successful, quote-unquote, legitimate business man in Mexico, who is very proud of the fact that his two, his son and his daughter, go to Ivy League universities in the United States. He has a construction company. And then one day he discovered that the trucks in his construction companies were being used by his employees to move, quote unquote, things across the border. And he discovered that because he had a very hard time retaining the drivers. He discovered that there was a very high turnover among the drivers. And lo and behold, he discovered that the drivers in just one short trip using the trucks of the company were able to make several years worth of the salaries that he was paying them. And so one day, Joe, almost half jokingly, he told one of his trusted employees that, you know, if they were using the trucks of the company, they should reward the company for that. And that is how he started, by financing and allowing the transfer of drugs across the border. And he joked that everybody was involved in this, and that in the border between Mexico and the United States, it's very hard to have illicit legal activity that is not touched in some way, directly or indirectly, by the illicit trades of people, drugs, and other things.
Do you think that the research you've done into illegal manufacturing and sales networks has any implications for homeland security in the U.S.?
Yes, I think it has huge implications. As a result of doing this and trying to understand how can it be contained, I did look quite carefully into the workings of the governments, and not only the U.S. government. And the first thing you discover is how fragmented is the workings of the government. For example, the illicit trade in counterfeits is centered in the Commerce Department, whereas the drug trafficking is the Drug Enforcement the Drug Enforcement Agency. The trafficking in people is centered in the State Department, but there are also several other agencies in government. The money laundering is at the Treasury Department. And each one of them talks to each other, but they belong to different organizations with different bosses, with different priorities, different budgets, and great difficulties in coordinating their activities. And that is just within one government. And just imagine that all of these traders thrive in being international. governments are very good at working inside the borders of the country. Government and government agencies have a very hard time working in other jurisdictions, in other countries. Traffickers and illegal traffickers thrive instead in working across borders. So you have agencies, government agencies, that are bound and restricted by the national borders. And you have traders that are exploiting the possibility of moving stealthily and very effectively across borders and that thrive in the in-between between sovereign nations.
In your book, Illicit, you say that you think civil wars, failed states, really make life a lot easier for that illegal economy, for that criminal economy. I'm wondering if you think that the war in Iraq and the chaos now in Iraq is having any effect on the illicit network of, you know, drugs and arms and other things.
There is no doubt that there is a lot of smuggling that is going on in Iraq of all kinds. The Minister of Finance of Iraq, Ali Alawi, told me the other day, that he is convinced that about half of the money that is now being invested or spent in Iraq in its reconstruction is being lost to illicit activities and corruption. It's very hard. There is no doubt that what is driving the Iraq insurgency and the Iraq instability is driven by politics and religion. But there is also no doubt that there is a lot of profit-making. There is a lot of violence and there is a lot of instability that is driven by profit-making networks that are exploiting the situation to become immensely wealthy.
Moises Naim, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Moises Naim is the author of the new book, Illicit. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by My Morning Jacket. This is Fresh Air. My Morning Jacket is a band from Louisville, Kentucky, that formed in 1998 around songwriter and lead singer Jim James. They've been the opening act for stars ranging from Bob Dylan to the Foo Fighters. Now they're headliners, and they appear in Cameron Crowe's new movie, Elizabethtown. My Morning Jacket has just released its fourth album called Z. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
As you can tell by that song called Lay Low, My Morning Jacket's lead singer Jim James has a tremulous voice that is thickened and deepened by layers of reverberation. When that sound is swaddled in the group's chiming guitars, drums, and keyboards, the result is a rich, dreamy sound that complements the airily obtuse lyrics that Jim James writes. Sorry about the things that I say.
Something else.
My Morning Jacket using a modified reggae beat to talk confusingly about how, as Jim James sings, I really don't need the confusion, and how he's not the type to, quote, get all wrapped up in the illusion of doing something that I know ain't right. Huh? Well, whatever. I'm into My Morning Jacket for the music, the sound, not the lyrics. James could be muttering nonsense syllables for all I care, and sometimes he does indeed bend and distend words and notes into unintelligibility. But it's the sort of confusion a listener is happy to get lost in. Because they come from a southern state and take long guitar solos, they get compared to the Allman Brothers and Lynyrd Skynyrd. Indeed, director Cameron Crowe used this as a sort of inside joke when he had the band play Skynyrd's Free Bird in his latest movie, Elizabethtown. But I think much of My Morning Jacket's sound is more reminiscent of middle-period Neil Young, the Tonight's the Night, On the Beach Neil Young, in which the yowling yawp of the vocal expresses more yearning than any mere lyric could do. There's a prime example of My Morning Jacket working at full speed, making a loping melody chug along faster than expected, with James's vocal racing ahead of the guitars and slamming drums. This is a musical metaphor for what I hear as My Morning Jacket's most frequent theme. The idea that everyday life has a kind of urgent grandeur, that passions and problems rise up quickly, often with a swiftness that surpasses human understanding. In its own very secular way, My Morning Jacket is a spiritual band in the sense that their grandly reverberated vocals and instruments try their best to embody the inexplicable, the ineffable. Or as Jim James says in that song called Anytime, words only got in the way, but then I found another way to communicate. They have a sense of humor about their mission. James insists, quote, what Madonna said really helped. She said, boy, you better learn to express yourself. I think Jim James took that idea to heart on this album. He decided to make noise, the sound of his voice inextricably combined with the band's instruments, to render all the expressions of loneliness, triumph, and confusion he wanted to get across.
Ken Tucker is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed Z by My Morning Jacket. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Joan Tuohy-Westman, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross. By the way, I just recorded an interview with Bruce Springsteen. We'll play it Tuesday, the day that his new Born to Run box set will be released. We'll close today's show with the title song from his now classic 1975 album.
Sprung from cages on high.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Alzheimer's Association, advancing research, providing care and support services, and promoting healthy brains at ALZ.org. And from members of the American Institute of Architects, working to create valuable and sustainable buildings and communities. Good design makes a difference at AIA.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our Veterans Day edition, we feature interviews with soldiers who have written memoirs about their time in Iraq. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.